It's time for Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today, Toledo residents try to get a Lake Erie Bill of Rights on the ballot.
We wanted a stronger, enforceable way to be able to protect ourselves, protect our communities, and protect the environment.
Research is looking into using biology to produce plastics.
There are bioplastics that are on the market today that are currently competitive with fossil fuel-based plastics.
A report analyzes how Michigan state government will do during the next recession.
We've made future spending commitments or tax cut commitments that we haven't figured out how we're going to pay for.
And bringing people from all across the political spectrum together to discuss hot-button issues.
You don't win by convincing others at the table that your view is right. You win by leaving with a sense of understanding why others hold the values and the views that they do.
Plus, a new effort to attract young professionals to Detroit called Text a Detroiter. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. How will Michigan fare in the next recession? According to an analysis out this month by Moody's, not very well. Joining me to talk about that are our Friday political commentators, Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. So Moody's Analytics designed a stress test for the states to see how well each state was prepared for a moderate recession scenario. Michigan came in at number 35, right alongside Arkansas and Mississippi. Ken, why do you think Michigan is faring so poorly in this exercise?
Well, just for the record, you know, our current expansion has kind of been long by historical standards. I mean, in the last 50 years, it's the current expansion in terms of its length has only been exceeded by the whole decade of the 90s. But I think part of it is that although Michigan has done some good things like putting money away for a rainy day fund, there are some other things, other decisions, frankly, that have been made that commit future spending without acknowledging that they're not paid for, or even future tax cuts like the personal property tax cut that aren't paid for. So I think one of the reasons, from my point of view, that Michigan probably isn't established well for a recession is that we've made future spending commitments or tax cut commitments that we haven't figured out how we're going to pay for.
Vicki, what are the consequences not being better prepared for an economic downturn?
Well, despite an economic downturn, we're still not prepared at all. Last year at this time, we were talking about the potential for a $2 billion shortfall in 4 years in the state of Michigan, which is now 3 years, based on exactly those things that Ken was talking about, giving tax breaks to businesses without figuring out how to pay for it, and committing general fund money to road projects and other projects that we haven't really figured out how to pay for, on top of the tax cuts and tax breaks that we were giving. So we were already headed toward a $2 billion shortfall. You add a recession on to that, and we're looking at possibly a $3 or $4 billion shortfall.
Well, even with the projections you guys are talking about, the majority of the Michigan legislature is determined not to raise taxes. While the roads are falling apart, we don't have money for cleaning up pollution. We're stealing money from school aid fund to get money to colleges and universities. I mean, how are we going to set aside more money?
It seems to me that when times are good, look, this issue isn't rocket science. It's as old as the Old Testament when Joseph was running things in Egypt, and he had 7 good years, and he said, look, we got to set something aside for the 7 bad years that are coming. So I think you salt some money away, and I think you credit the governor and the current legislature for having done that. We've got almost $1 billion in a rainy day fund. But secondly, and we've talked about this, you got to curtail the appetite to make future spending commitments that aren't paid for.
Moody's Analytics said the economic impact of putting that dollar aside today when the economy is red hot will be much less painful than trying to pull it out of the economy at the height of the next recession. Vicki, is Lansing listening to those kinds of warnings?
No, they're not. It's much easier to save money when you have money. We all know that. It's also much more fun to spend money when you have money. But we need to start putting the money away while we have it. When you have a recession, we have a tightening of the revenue stream coming into the state at the same time that we have an increase in spending in terms of Medicaid, unemployment insurance, mental health services. So we spend more in a recession for services that we don't spend more on when the economy is pumping along. But I want to just go back and talk a minute about where we are. In 1998, the general fund budget of the state of Michigan was $8.7 billion. If you account for inflation in real dollars, that's $13.7 billion, and we're barely at a $10 billion general fund revenue stream. So we have not even kept up with inflation in this state, and we're still trying to play catch-up, not to mention what we've done to the school aid fund, which is way underwater if we talk about real dollars. So we've been in a tax cut mentality without, as Ken said, looking toward how to pay for those cuts as the economy continues to churn forward. And we've used general fund money and, indeed, extra rainy day money that the governor wanted to put away, that the legislature said, no, we're going to pump that into roads because we don't have the guts to really fix the fixing of our road problem, which is a $2 billion annual need that we're not addressing.
I was looking at tax burdens. Last year, Bridge Magazine reported state and local taxes in 1977 were 9% higher than the national average. By 2014, Michigan's per capita tax burden was 19% below the national average. I looked at that in 2018 dollars. Basically, that meant we were paying per person $1,156 in 1977 and $952 in 2014. Ken, is that progress or does that mean the state is falling behind?
We've been through this before. In the decade of the 90s, we had a huge economic expansion, even greater than the one we're currently experiencing. And so in the late 90s, we started annually cutting the state income tax. But a few short years later, we had to postpone those tax cuts because of the recession. So to me, the issue is, you know, you've got to balance the budget at the state level. You have to recognize there are going to be some needs that are out there, and some of those needs go up when you have a recession, such as health and human services. And I think that's, once again, I think that's where the state is falling short looking down the road here.
Vicki, is a smaller tax burden for the average person a good thing, or does it mean the state's falling behind?
Well, the state's falling behind, as well as the rich are getting richer and the middle class is shrinking and the poor are getting poorer. And a lot of the jobs that have been created really don't keep pace with a growth in wages for residents of the state of Michigan who really haven't seen their overall paychecks keeping pace with inflation and growing. So add to that student debt and a whole host of other factors, and the state is falling behind, and the state is falling apart. There's no one that's going to tell you that the crisis in our drinking water isn't real and that we have a problem with fixing our infrastructure. So I don't know if the tax burden alone in isolation is really a descriptor for how we should be looking at the quality of services and quality of life that a state provides. I think we need to begin to look at what do we need to pay for, how much does it cost, and how do we provide that as a basic service for people, and what is the burden on the average taxpayer and on the business taxpayer, and how do we balance that with the needs to attract people and businesses to the state of Michigan with a high quality of life.
I want to ask both of you, are we having these kinds of conversations in Lansing anymore?
I don't think so.
Well, you don't have any substantive conversations 7 weeks before an election, Lester. My friends and neighbors in West Michigan, nobody's clamoring for a tax cut, Lester. They're talking about fixing the roads. They're talking about the need to improve education, but nobody's really out there clamoring, insisting upon some small tax cut. I think that reflects their understanding that there are some things that you need to invest in, and they cost money. I mean, you can't fix the roads just by wishing it being done. You got to have revenue to fix the roads.
And add to that term limits where legislators come in and they figure they have to do something. And on the Republican side, it's been the mantra to cut taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes. And you still have legislators on the Republican side that want to come in and do away with the state income tax altogether, regardless of what the effect will be on schools and roads and the state of Michigan as a whole. So we still have to fight against that. And I think that term limits have not been our friend to encourage these kinds of long-term discussions, because most of these types of discussions used to happen outside of the committee process in getting to know your legislative neighbor and figuring out who you could trust to have these conversations with. And that just doesn't happen anymore.
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Lester.
This year's midterm election is gearing up to be pretty contentious. To better understand the issues that are most important to Michigan voters, we put out reporters and producers throughout the state to ask people two questions. What are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And what concerns you most about our political climate right now? From now until the election, we'll be bringing you their answers in a segment called Voter Voices. This is our second installment. First, we'll hear from Kathleen Anderson.
I'm a retired registered nurse from Saginaw, Michigan. I think healthcare coverage needs to be more across the board as opposed to private payers. I think we need to have something more global. As far as car insurance, Michigan pays the most highest in all of the states. And I don't know why that is, but it needs to be lower. And as far as taxes go, I think that's an ongoing issue with most people. We always pay too much for taxes, but I know it's necessary, but still in the same breath, something could be done so that it's across the board, especially for retirees. I'm retired and living on a fixed limited income, it makes a big difference.
Do you have concerns about the current political climate?
There's a lot of dissension among all the parties. I think we just needed to get it together so that we're all one and on the same note, but certainly I know that's not possible. But there shouldn't be this backstabbing one part or the other, and we just need to get it together.
My name is Martin Curran. I live on the west side of Detroit, and my occupation, I'm an attorney. As a Michigan voter, the most important issue to me is education. I'm really passionate about the education of the next generation, especially in the Black community. I want to see as much invested into them as wisely as possible because I believe in them and they're the future. What concerns me most about the political climate right now are the signs of instability that I think a lot of Americans fail to appreciate. The fact that there's a man in charge of the country who doesn't understand basic concepts, therefore he himself is not really able to make decisions for the country, and the fact that he has so little respect for rule of law. That situation can be manipulated by certain factors. It can lead to things which spin out of control. If this administration really, really messes up and he's not really the one doing it, who's going to take the blame? Where's the accountability? You know, there's so many things. So I think there are serious signs of instability because of the current administration. And I just hope that it turns out okay.
Special thanks to Rozzy Joffrey and Interlochen Public Radio's Morgan Springer and Daniel Wanshura for recording these interviews. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've got a plastic problem. Perhaps you've heard of the huge patches of plastic in the ocean, or recently on this program that there are tiny plastic particles found in Great Lakes tap water, even Great Lakes beer. Society's response? Let's ban plastic straws. It's symbolic, but really doesn't even come close to solving the problem. Think about all the products you buy in a plastic container, especially food products. Well, there are some plant-based plastic alternatives. Henry Ford experimented with soybean-based plastic. 30 years ago, corn growers were touting the new cornstarch-based plastic bags that were developed. The method wasn't perfect, but it was a sign that people were thinking about alternatives. Join us to talk more about that. What's being called bioplastics is Danny Duquette. He's an assistant professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at Michigan State University. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with what you're working on at your lab. You're putting to use an organism we've heard about in this area, cyanobacteria, which is known to people who live near Lake Erie because it caused the city of Toledo to shut down its water for a few days back in 2014. You're finding cyanobacteria useful in bioplastic development. How's that?
So we're specifically studying these relatively ancient bacteria, as you mentioned, cyanobacteria, because they have all of the same photosynthetic machinery present in their cells that you find in higher order plants. And that means that they can conduct photosynthesis, they can capture sunlight and CO2, and then convert that into useful products. And so our lab is specifically looking at trying to engineer these cyanobacteria in order to produce sugars that can be used for the production of bio-based plastics. So in today's processing, we typically use plant-based sugars, things from relatively sugar-rich plants like corn, sugarcane, and sugar beet. And we refine sugars from those plants and turn them into the polymers that will ultimately become bioplastics. And we hope that by using cyanobacteria, we can not only create those sugars more efficiently, but also do so in a way that doesn't compete for arable land or potable water.
So you're basically using a bacteria to harness sunlight to make plastic.
Exactly.
Wow. So is there a lot of bioplastic being used today?
Currently, the market for plastics is huge, as you mentioned. They're pretty much in everything that we come into contact in our daily lives. There's about 300 million plus tons of plastic that are being generated every year, and only about 1% of those are currently bioplastics.
Hmm. What are they being used in primarily?
One of the main targets for bioplastics really are single-use plastics, because things like plastics that come into contact with food or other potential contaminants can sometimes be difficult to process in recycling streams. So in the case of bioplastics, we'd like to be able to replace the fossil fuel-based plastics with ones that not only are more sustainable, because this is a huge stream of plastics that are in the single-use plastics market, but also because some bioplastics can then be broken back down or biodegrade back into simple components that don't contaminate landscapes.
I mean, I've seen there are like plastic forks and things like that out there. Are there other things that commonly we might run into?
Exactly, yeah. So one of the main markets for bioplastics currently are things like food packaging, clamshells that you might get your takeaway food in, plastic cutlery, or plastic wraps.
Let's take a big step back. Why do we need to develop bioplastics? Why don't we just do a better job of recycling the petroleum-based plastics that we've already made?
Well, it's definitely a multi-pronged problem that's going to require a number of different solutions, right? So currently, only about 10% of plastics that are produced are recycled. The vast majority of the remainder go to incinerators or to landfills. And so there's certainly a lot of space for increasing our recycling of a number of different plastics. But some plastics that come into, say, contact with foods can become contaminated in ways that make it difficult to recycle them. So having additional alternatives, such as bio-based plastics that can be broken back down, allows us to reprocess those types of plastics without them necessarily ending up in a landfill.
If they don't go in the landfill, how do we get rid of them? I mean, how do we dispose of bioplastics?
Bioplastics that are compostable can be processed in industrial composting facilities where they'll be mixed with some other organic matters, and typically the temperatures are quite high in these industrial composters, and those can break the plastics right back down into their basic building blocks that can then be used to enrich the soil and to form compost.
Now, you're stressing the need for investment in not only bioplastics, but basically composting facilities that can handle bioplastics. So how soon and how likely will bioplastics be developed well enough and cheaply enough that they rival petroleum-based plastics for the marketplace?
Well, surprisingly enough, there are bioplastics that are on the market today that are currently competitive with fossil fuel-based plastics. One of these types of plastics is called PLA, or polylactic acid, and a big part of the development of that polymer was done right here in Michigan at the Michigan Bioindustry Institute in partnership with Michigan State University and Cargill. But some of these other bioplastic alternatives are not necessarily good for all applications, and we're still looking for ways to improve upon their properties for, say, food-based packaging, things like the thermotolerance or stability of the plastics, as well as to improve their ability to be broken down in composting facilities. There's really only currently about 200 composting facilities around in the U.S., which means that there definitely is a bottleneck in downstream processing facilities that can handle bioplastic. And so it's going to need to be both a increase in the diversity of suitable plastics that are bio-based, degradable plastics, as well as the facilities that can be used to break those plastics back down.
Well, assuming we get there, of course, that doesn't deal with the huge volume of petroleum-based plastic already in the environment where it will be for centuries. Danny Ducat is an assistant professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at Michigan State University. He wrote an article on bioplastics for The Conversation. It's called Bio-Based Plastics Can Reduce Waste, but Only If We Invest in Both Making and Getting Rid of Them. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
saw in the Toledo Blade that some Toledo residents are outraged that the Lucas County Board of Elections rejected a ballot initiative that had nearly twice as many signatures as required. The initiative called for a Lake Erie Bill of Rights. A group called Toledoans for Safe Water organized the petition drive. Marky Miller is an organizer, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Lake Erie Bill of Rights is based on this idea known as rights of nature. Would you explain that to us?
Sure. So rights of nature is kind of a legal concept in saying that we need to recognize that natural ecosystems have these inalienable rights that we should be able to enforce and protect. We've kind of seen this trend of nature as property to be bought and sold and used and destroyed. And, you know, when it comes down to it, is that people and life are supported by this natural infrastructure. So we wanted a stronger, enforceable way to be able to protect ourselves, protect our communities, and protect the environment.
So what did the Lake Erie Bill of Rights call for?
It called for a stronger protection of the water and saying that you don't have the right to harm the ecosystem, to harm the water, to pollute. That, you know, regardless of you having permission or a permit or, you know, ownership, you can't just blatantly destroy this water or carry out activities that would then require extensive cleanup and treatment and public health problems. You know, we've been facing here in Toledo the looming toxic algae seasons now, and seeing that we've been able to identify activities that contribute to that, but we have no way of stopping those.
So the idea is, just like a corporation has rights in this country, a lake might have rights and people could sue on behalf of the lake. Who would get to act on behalf of Lake Erie?
It would be the city of Toledo, the government of Toledo, the local government, as well as the residents here, the people who live here. So essentially, we get to act as trustees of Lake Erie and speak on its behalf. And it, you know, wouldn't be Marky Miller versus, you know, whatever corporation or government is doing the harm, but it would be Lake Erie versus, and I would get to help bring my evidence and my case to light.
Couldn't there be competing interests deciding that they were going to represent Lake Erie?
Well, anybody can, you know, represent it. So it doesn't have to just come from the group that put it forth. We want to just put this out there as a more proactive solution.
I think that's what I'm getting at. I mean, you might, you know, on behalf of Lake Erie, sue for one thing, and a group countering what you want to do might sue on behalf of Lake Erie using a different argument and at cross purposes. That could get pretty messy pretty quickly, couldn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly how it would look in every case, but that's where we have the ability to have the discretion and the evidence. You know, it's not kind of a set in stone, oh, yeah, you're doing this, we need to stop it. You have to be able to prove it. So, you know, I think, yeah, any law, people can kind of pick and choose how they want to apply it.
Well, let's get back to your ballot initiative. What reason did the Lucas County Board of Elections give for rejecting it?
They said that we don't have the right as a municipality to create a cause of action. So we can't create this private right to sue, and that it's beyond the scope of the municipality.
You weren't, though. You were just putting a ballot initiative up. I mean, isn't that something you would typically challenge in court after the people voted?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It, you know, the Board of Elections should really have this ministerial role to say, you know, yes, all of the signatures were turned in and they were verified, and you know, we turned everything into the clerk of council first and had it approved how many signatures we needed. So there's this competing view now that it's up to local board of elections to decide what people can and cannot vote on. A lot of that comes from House Bill 463 that was passed in 2016 that kind of gave boards of elections this local right. And even though we've been trying to come out with that, seeing how unconstitutional that is, and we've had victories with that court case in saying, yes, it is unconstitutional. If you have a chartered amendment or a chartered city, you can't do that. But it continues to come down to a case-by-case issue.
Well, you appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court, and it ruled against you. So what is your group, Toledoans for Safe Water, plan to do now?
We've actually already filed for reconsideration. Our lawyers have put that out there, and we're still waiting to hear back on that decision. You know, if you go through, I would encourage everybody who's interested in this, though, to go find that docket. It's all public, and read through their decision, because they don't really get into, let's talk about the legality of a Lake Erie Bill of Rights. You know, they focus on these other kind of technical issues. They state, we may have made errors in our previous judgments, but we're not going to approach those today. We're not going to make that decision or make those discussions today. For now, we're just going to continue on. But it's worth saying that we may have made some errors in the past. They even say that because our city council didn't pass an ordinance before we submitted it, and that our city charter is therefore out of compliance with the state constitution, that, oh, we, you know, that's our problem, and now we're not allowed to vote, and we have to go back. So it really isn't this grand ruling against rights of nature or against Lake Erie Bill of Rights. It's kind of this back-and-forth discussion, and in a way you see them start to question past rulings, they question each other, they question all the things that come up, but it's not very satisfying to see it, because you want to start seeing rights of nature become more of a discussion. And so we've asked them to go back and reconsider and take another look.
There have been attempts in this country to give animals legal standing, rights of nature, and that's been rejected as well. Why did you think nature rights would be successful?
Well, you know, I think it comes down to all the times in history when we've been expanding rights, and we can't deny that our existence, our health, and the quality of our economy, all of that comes down to the health of our environment. And those are questions we need to get serious about and need to start asking and bring to public light. You know, I might not see rights of nature in my lifetime happen in the United States, but I know that I'm starting to ask different questions, and I'm trying to get those questions to become more commonplace, so that when my kids grow up, maybe they will get to see it. Maybe they'll have a chance, you know, to live in a different world. We're seeing this happen in other countries. You know, we're far behind.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, there are places where rights of nature laws have been enacted. How have they worked out?
Yeah, I mean, Ecuador has had it in their constitution for 10 years. You know, and there are cases where rivers were given the right to flow despite construction projects that wanted to come through. So, you know, we are seeing little victories. We're just not seeing them in the United States yet. And I'm hoping that part of the work we're doing today will be seen down the road.
If this ultimately fails, what's your next move?
It's hard to say right now. You know, it's not something I'm going to give up. It's definitely going to be part of my life's work, you know, from indefinitely. But I don't know yet. That's got to be a decision we make as a group. You know, I think a lot of what we're doing is waking people up to this injustice of, you know, whether you subscribe to more environmental perspective or not, you have to look at what's happening to your rights. And so we're becoming part of a growing community rights movement. And I don't know how that's going to look in Toledo and how it's going to look in Ohio, but I know it's starting to take a little more shape and gain a little more momentum. So we're definitely going to be back at it and back doing something. You know, we're not ready to give up.
Marky Miller is an organizer with the group Toledoans for Safe Water. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much.
Michigan is called one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. Proposal 2 on this November's ballot is an attempt to change that. Instead of letting politicians draw the maps like we do now, the proposal would create an independent redistricting commission to draw the boundaries of legislative districts. It's complicated, and of course it's political. We want to know, what questions do you have about Proposal 2? Go to Stateside, the Stateside page at michiganradio.org, or call us at 734-764-7840. Simply tell us your name, where you live, and ask your question. We'll try to get answers to as many of our questions as we can. Again, that phone number is 734-764-7840. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There are a lot of variables in attracting and keeping talented young workers. A lot of that has to do with how vibrant your city happens to be or is perceived to be. But how do you get their attention when they're in another state and haven't thought about your state or your city as a career destination? We're going to talk about that. Joining me is Whitney Griffin, the president of Detroit Young Professionals. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the basics. What is the goal of Detroit Young Professionals?
Detroit Young Professionals is a nonprofit organization whose mission and goal is to attract and retain talent in this Metro Detroit region. And we do that by providing opportunities for our members and the network to grow personally and professionally, connect with fellow young professionals, and to give back to the city so that they feel like they have a place to belong.
So if you're trying to attract young professionals from out of town, what do you tell them about Detroit?
Well, we definitely showcase all the wonderful things that are happening, and this is something we've been doing since 2007, so long before a lot of, you know, Detroit as these newcomers see it today. We've been doing this for a long time when there was a serious issue of brain drain happening, and so we have long curated the story of wonderful things that are happening in the city and ways that young professionals can grow. And so, you know, we'll definitely do that by providing information about professional and personal development opportunities, but also just ways to build community by connecting with their fellow young professionals.
Okay, I want to hear the elevator pitch. Let's say I'm a young professional in another state. What's Detroit got for me?
So as a young professional, Detroit has a variety of opportunities to grow personally and professionally. There are a ton of wonderful companies here that are interested in the development of career growth and opportunities for young professionals.
Tell me about Let's Detroit. What is Let's Detroit?
So Let's Detroit is a platform that is helping to increase connectivity amongst Detroiters, both new and old. So it's a way for people to connect more with the city and to engage and experience all of the great things that are happening right now.
And then tell me about Text a Detroiter. That's kind of part of this Let's Detroit, right?
Exactly. That is the whole idea of Let's Detroit. The texting functionality really helps for people. That's pretty much how people are connecting with the city and other Detroiters. So it leverages similar technology that we use through Uber and the ride-sharing apps to connect with your drivers. So it's pretty confidential. But the texting functionality, basically you can ask a question, you know, where can I go get a bite to eat for brunch? And someone who is an ambassador, like myself, we can answer your question and provide, you know, all these great recommendations to our favorite places to get brunch in the city.
Now, aren't the ambassadors coached into giving certain answers, or is it just whatever the ambassador thinks?
The ambassadors are gone through like sort of a selection process. They can select topics that they're experts in. So the Detroit Regional Chamber has worked with several organizations, recruited a ton of ambassadors who have all identified themselves as experts in different areas. And so the question will go to people who, you know, have selected to be an ambassador in that area.
So tell me, what kind of texts are you guys getting?
We've gotten everything from where can I hear live music on a Tuesday night, all the way to where can I volunteer and give back to the city. So there's been a wide range of questions that we've received in different ways that people want to engage.
That is Whitney Griffin, the president of Detroit Young Professionals. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been great to be on.
Let's turn now to the CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber, Sandy Barua. Right now, I understand 36% of those graduating from Michigan colleges and universities leave. What does Detroit and Michigan need to do to keep them here?
Well, we need to have fewer of them leave. You know, now the good news is, Lester, that a higher percentage of graduates of Michigan schools are staying in Michigan than they were 5, 10, 20 years ago. That's good news. The bad news is that we're still not retaining enough of them. So we need to do a better job of retaining our great talent here in the state of Michigan, and we need to do a better job of attracting talent that is grown and developed elsewhere.
How is this Let's Detroit program or effort going to keep that young talent or attract them?
So there is, to date, until Let's Detroit, there has not been a cohesive region-wide effort that is a single portal that is a live, work, play portal for the greater Detroit, Ann Arbor region. If you wanted to connect on a professional basis with fellow Detroiters, you'd have to join one of many, several very good associations, but there was no one place that kind of had all of those things. If you wanted to learn about communities, if you wanted to know what Ann Arbor was like to live in versus Ferndale versus the Corktown neighborhood in Detroit, you'd have to kind of investigate those things independently online. There was no one central place for that. If you wanted to meet a Detroiter, if you live in Denver, you say, hey, listen, I just want to talk to a Detroiter, see what it's like, you know, someone my age, someone who's interested in my things. How would you do that? Now you can do that through Let's Detroit.
I'm wondering, what's the perception of Detroit right now by people who don't know the city?
So it really depends on the audience. From a business investment community standpoint, the city of Detroit and, frankly, Michigan couldn't be any hotter. We are known as a next-generation mobility hub. We're known as a water technology hub, an IT hub, and just the turnaround at the state and particularly in the city of Detroit, it really has national attention. We also have a similar reputation with young professional, creative types, engineers, IT professionals. They are really coming to this area. Where the reputation still hasn't caught up with is kind of the average person walking down the street in Phoenix or Seattle who maybe hasn't been here in 5 years or 10 years or maybe never been here. They do have an outdated view of the city, but other audiences think very, very highly of us.
This Text a Detroiter idea that I was talking to Whitney Griffin about, this was patterned after Sweden's Call a Swede tourism campaign. I read in an Adweek article from a couple of years ago that they actually talking to a random Swede made a better connection than social media. So I'm wondering, why Text a Detroiter rather than Call a Detroiter?
Well, what do people do with their phones today? They actually don't talk on them all that much. They actually communicate via their thumbs. And so this is really kind of the modern version of the phone call. You know, the texting function is just kind of now ingrained, especially in our target audience, that millennial age folks. Although I will say that the Let's Detroit platform and the Text a Detroiter piece of it is just one element of the Let's Detroit platform and website. It's for all ages, but we're paying particular attention to that, essentially that millennial group.
So we heard what Detroit young professionals are doing. We hear what the chamber is doing. What are individual businesses doing to aid in this effort?
So this is one of the reasons why we have Let's Detroit, because businesses do a good job, sometimes a very good job, selling themselves. This is what it's like to go work for Henry Ford Health System or Lear Corporation, you know, or Blue Cross Blue Shield. What they don't have access to is, how do I sell the region? So if I've got someone who's going to come in as, say, a senior accountant or a junior engineer, how do I tell them about what life is going to be like in Ann Arbor or Troy or Detroit? There really wasn't that ability to do that. And then for the companies that don't have these very sophisticated kind of talent attraction and retention apparatuses, Let's Detroit can help fill those gaps in the organization.
Sandy, how many other cities are using this or a similar tactic to attract young professionals?
I think one of the best ways to do something is to steal from the very best, and that's exactly what we did. You mentioned the Sweden experience. We also stole from our friends in West Michigan. There's a platform that's been up for several years called Hello West Michigan. It is one of the world-class platforms for talent attraction and retention. Denver has a strong program. There's other cities across the nation that have something similar to this. We're the only ones that we're aware of right now that has this texting back and forth functionality.
Sandy Barua is the CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Hey, nice talking to you again.
Great to be with you, Lester.
Political discourse, civil discourse these days is next to non-existent. There's lots of debating, lots of shouting, but not much of anything else. A student-based group at the University of Michigan wants to change that. We Listen describes itself as a grassroots, campus-based organization working to bridge the American political divide. Joining me now is one of the officers of We Listen, Yvonne Yao. Thanks for joining us. How did this idea come about?
Thank you so much for having me. We Listen was founded after the 2016 presidential election. A bunch of us on campus noticed that students weren't engaging in political conversation. There was a lot of tension, and there just wasn't civic discourse. So to change that, We Listen aimed to create a space where students from all backgrounds, perspectives, from all across the political spectrum could come and engage in a conversation on different topics and share their views.
Now, you're holding a big event soon. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But you bring people in, they have discussions. We've seen prominent conservative and prominent liberals on any given issue take their debate show on the road, visiting universities, colleges. How is this different?
I would say We Listen is different because, for one, we're completely student-run, and I think that coming from a student perspective on campus, we're much more aware and familiar with the dialogue and the conversations that are going on, and we're much more aware of the needs that we're missing in these conversations. So our aim is to bring together students and show them that in this space, no matter which way you lean and regardless of what kind of political background you hold, this is a space where you can be heard, and as long as you're willing to listen to others, then they'll be willing to listen to you as well.
I would think the kind of people, the kind of students who might attend an event like yours are the kind of people who already are open to the idea of hearing other viewpoints. How do you attract the people who are already determined exactly what they think, exactly what they believe, and they don't want to hear anybody else's viewpoint, which I think they'd be the most important people to get to an event like yours.
Right. So initially, we did a really great job of obviously bringing in the students who are already politically engaged, who are already very strong in their beliefs. At We Listen, we always say, you don't win by convincing others at the table that your view is right. You win by leaving with a sense of understanding why others hold the values and the views that they do. So I would say as we've come along and as we've developed, we've seen that we're having a harder time reaching all corners of campus in the sense that students who are studying things outside of political science and outside of public policy and inviting them and showing them that regardless of what the topic is, we all have a personal stake in this issue and you don't have to come in with a previous political background or expertise because you have a voice and it ought to be listened to.
Yeah, I think that segment of society might be growing. They're just disengaging because it's become so obnoxious in some cases.
Right. And I think We Listen does a really great job. We have a content team. So for every session, they come up with a fact sheet of news and relevant legislation, current events from both sides of the political aisle to provide this unbiased foundation and also has discussion questions, scenario questions. So it really helps guide the conversation. And we really want to focus that you're not required to come in with any sort of prior knowledge because we always kick off our conversations with just getting to know the people at your table as people. So it brings humanity to the conversation and encourages our participants to find a sense of empathy and common ground.
What kind of issues have you all discussed?
So this past year, we've talked about gun control, immigration, free speech on college campuses, and even abortion. With our upcoming conference, we'll be splitting up the participants to be talking about gun control, immigration, and college campus because those just seem to be the most pertinent.
There's been loud protests by liberal and or left-leaning students and faculty regarding some conservatives and some white supremacists appearing on campuses. There have been fewer, but also some protests by conservatives and right-leaning students, faculty about some liberal speakers. How are you preparing for a reaction like that when you start inviting these big-name guests in?
So We Listen actually has been pretty lucky. We found that both the student body and a lot of the administration at the university have been really receptive to our mission and what we're trying to do. We haven't faced a lot of pushback or a lot of radical views that have threatened what we're trying to do. So when we have these very right-leaning or left-leaning groups, I would say we haven't really interacted with them much. And we've just been able to stick to our mission, which has been great.
Are there people you would not invite to these discussions?
Again, we're really lucky. We haven't really faced that problem yet. I would say the challenge is definitely more making sure we're reaching out to the students who aren't usually very politically engaged and just showing them that we all have backgrounds and stories that shape our views and our values and that ought to be represented when we're having these discussions.
Now, you've got a big event this Sunday. Tell me about that.
So we're hosting our first ever We Listen to Fall conference on September 30th. We're really excited for it. We've invited 90 student leaders representing different organizations all across the Ann Arbor, Flint, and Dearborn, Michigan campuses. So we're starting off the day in our breakout sessions, as we usually do on our normal weekly basis, with discussions on immigration, free speech on college campuses, and gun control. Following that, we'll be having a policymaking workshop. So the aim of that is to show students that after you're able to engage in this type of discussion and showing that you can work with those even if they have different views than you, giving them these tangible skills to implement the change that we want to see. And then we'll be concluding the day with a panel discussion, and we'll be having Bill Kristol from the Weekly Standard and Neera Tanden from the Center for American Progress. That discussion will be moderated by Dean Barr, and closing remarks will be delivered by University President President Schlissel.
I'm wondering, what are the discussions like after you hold an event? I mean, are people like migrating to the coffee shop and continuing the conversation? And what happens?
That's definitely what we're trying to push for. We always end our discussions with a debriefing, always asking our participants, what have they learned? What were they surprised by? And how do they hope to continue the conversation? So essentially, We Listen is trying to be this launching platform where students can engage in these conversations, but it doesn't have to be within the context of our organization. You can be engaging in these conversations, finding common ground, and showing them that our differences can be meaningful and productive no matter where we are.
Have your positions been challenged? I mean, have you reconsidered where you're at on certain issues?
I definitely think so. When I first came into We Listen and joined the conversation, when you're forced to sit down and explain to others why you believe in the things you do, and learning and establishing those fundamentals and the foundations of those, it can be really difficult. So it honestly has made me believe that maybe sometimes I'm just blindly following the media or blindly following whatever headlines that pop up on my social media feed. So being able to engage and gain a stronger understanding of why I hold the values and why others hold the values that they do has been really awesome.
How's it change you? I mean, what's awesome about it? How does it make you a better citizen?
I think I'm much more cognizant of what I'm reading, what media I'm consuming. It's definitely made me more willing to listen to others don't hold the same views as I do, especially following the 2016 election. I think that initial polarization on campus was really detrimental to having this discourse that we really needed. So it's been really great to see that even if I'm in a space where I feel like I'm very strong in my beliefs, there's still a lot of value in listening to others.
These ought to be mandatory for legislators and members of Congress.
Hope so.
Yvonne Yao is the Vice President of Marketing for We Listen. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock, who brought in a big iced coffee for himself. Nothing for Lindsay. Nothing for me. We are very sad. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Natalie Brennan, Sam Corey, and Joy Horan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.